funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did General Stanley McChrystal lose his job as commander of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, and how has the American campaign fared under his leadership and in its wake? Michael Hastings is contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He spent a month with McChrystal and his staff during the general's tenure as head of U.S. operations in Afghanistan, which ended soon after the devastating portrait Hastings wrote of a command team openly disdainful of President Obama, Vice President Biden, and their plan to limit the use of the counterterrorism strategy McChrystal wanted. Hastings shares more details about the events surrounding those extraordinary weeks with McChrystal's inner circle and how the war has proceeded since his departure in his new book, The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You had done a great deal of war reporting before the time you spent with McChrystal. What did it take for you to arrange that extended access to him and also to his team?
Well, I started covering the war in Iraq in 2005 for Newsweek magazine, and then I was made their Baghdad correspondent there. And then after leaving Newsweek, I went to GQ and then Rolling Stone, where I was covering the wars in Afghanistan. To get the interview with General McChrystal, I had wanted to do a profile of a top general for quite a long time. It was an idea I had years ago, but the opportunity never really arose. So I just sent an email to his top staff saying, you know, we want to do a profile of you and Rolling Stone. You're coming up on a year anniversary of when you've been in charge. And I think there's, you know, could be a great story here.
So, I mean, McChrystal must have known, or at least his staff must have known, that in addition to writing about celebrities, that the magazine does serious journalism. Did you get the sense at all that they were concerned about your presence, or did they just assume that you would write something flattering?
I believe they assumed I would write something flattering, but I didn't get the sense that they had even Googled my work. When I started talking to them and met them, because I honestly did not expect to get any access for the story, or at least fairly limited, because I'd been such a vocal critic of the war in Afghanistan and General McChrystal himself. I mean, on the record and on the internet, on the radio, on the television, in magazine stories, you know, I had been quite a critic of the policy. So I was quite surprised. On the other hand, it showed the sort of confidence that McChrystal's people had in himself, where their basic feeling was, how could you not love this guy? How could you not love him like we do? And how could you not see that he is, as they called him, a rock star?
Yeah, and you have called both him and David Petraeus sort of sacred cows, even for American journalists who typically are pretty tough on leadership.
Yeah, there's a strange thing about reporting on generals. They are treated and have been treated very differently from most other public figures who reach that level of prominence and have that much power. And you know, if you think about it with General Petraeus, for instance, there had never really been a critical profile or critical presentation of him written until Bob Woodward actually has written the most critical things about General Petraeus, surprisingly enough. With General McChrystal, there had been no actual critical coverage of him in the profile round. There had been some criticism of his role in the Pat Tillman affair, who was the former NFL star who was killed by friendly fire. There had been some criticism of him in human rights reports for McChrystal's role in the sort of torture networks that were set up in Iraq, but all the profiles have made him out to be sort of the superhuman hero who was going to single-handedly win the war. And as a writer who covers this stuff too, it just didn't feel right to me. I was like, there's something off with how we're presenting this guy to the public.
Based on what you found and what you wrote in the article and now in the book, it's fair to ask this question: did you go into the story expecting to rip this guy to shreds?
No. I think I was quite surprised by the response. I certainly never thought he was going to get fired. And I think if one even reads the original story and the book, the picture one gets of General McChrystal is fair. I mean, people come away liking him. I mean, it's interesting. People have said to me, "Well, I read the book and, you know, I agree with you on the war, but I kind of like General McChrystal." I'm like, "Yeah, I mean, that was my intent, because I in fact also like him and his staff." But you know, my views on the war certainly were, there was, it would have, unless they could have totally convinced me that, you know, we were doing such great things in Afghanistan, that everything I'd seen and witnessed myself over the previous few years was not accurate, then it would have been difficult for me not to have criticized the war.
So he arrived, General McChrystal did, in Iraq and later Afghanistan with very impressive military credentials, although he had this history of sort of bucking authority stretching all the way back to his time at West Point. Can you tell us a little bit about his background?
Yeah, he's a fascinating, you know, historical character. He's a General Patton or General MacArthur in that the attributes that gave birth to his meteoric rise within the military also turned out to be what contributed to what we could call a downfall or the sort of implosion. And at West Point, his father was a general. According to his classmates there, he partied all the time, drank a lot, which is, by the way, you know, not to be a hypocrite, I did that in college as well. unfortunately, I did get kicked out of school, but ended up graduating eventually on time. But you know, so he had pushed the envelope, and then there was a famous story of General McChrystal at West Point where he and his buddies dressed up as commandos. This is in the 70s, and then raided the kind of the cafeteria essentially. When they had women guests over and tipped over tables and threw fake grenades and just sort of caused general mayhem. So you know, his mischievous spirit was with him all this time, and you can go and look at what he wrote for a literary magazine at West Point where he has these incredible stories. And it's all about messing with the system and, mm-hmm. and overthrowing authority. So the traditional path to generalship would not necessarily be within the Rangers or Special Forces community, but he decided to go that path anyway.
Was he a good writer, by the way?
I compared it to, I think my line, I have some line. Have you read kind of like Trying to Be Naked in the Dead by Norman Mailer, but not making it?
Yeah.
But clearly, look, I mean,
well, a lot of 21-year-olds write stuff that feels great at the time. I mean, in his defense.
And trust me, you know, as Thomas Pynchon once said, you know, if he looks at a check he wrote 2 weeks ago, he feels pain. you know, not to mention, you know, stuff that I wrote when I was 18, 19, 20. Oh, my God. But it shows an active mind, an engaged mind, someone who's quite more intellectual than he would later pretend not to be. He sort mm-hmm. of tried to pretend to be this, you know, jock, beer-drinking kind of buddy-buddy jock. But you could tell at reading his early works that there was a real intellect that he had. And in fact, he, you know, people consider him quite brilliant, and I think that's reflected in his career as well as in his early writings.
Well, it's funny because the next hour of this show, we're going to talk about how situations affect the way people behave, and the same person can genuinely be the beer-drinking jock and the intellectual depending on the day and the situation.
And this is what's key, I think, in trying to understand what happened in the book is, you know, the sort of boozy, wild road trip that I tried to make it sort of compelling and entertaining and accurate as possible. But, you know, the question I often had was, you know, because I'm the observer from Rolling Stone, mm-hmm. if that did not, in fact, contribute to the everyone acting like we were, you know, part of the Beastie Boys or Led
yeah.
Zeppelin. And I think there's a part of that. I think, you know, had I been a reporter for the New York Times or some other outlet, maybe they would have acted differently. But the other thing is, the stuff that I reported would not have gotten the New York Times or Newsweek or anything like that.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute, because interestingly, some of your colleagues in journalism who likely witnessed perhaps similar things at different times were annoyed with you for writing on the record things that you were not told to put off the record, but they would have done almost as a courtesy or as a professional convention?
As sort of a voluntary censorship.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting. The reaction, there were sort of two reactions. One was that all these Washington journalists said, well, yeah, people say that stuff all the time. We just don't report it. And I was like, okay. And the other reaction was, oh, we've never heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
I think what was disturbing about the response was that sort of a misunderstanding of, you know, look, I'm there to write a profile. You know, there's 40 years of magazine history, which reveals, you know, what a profile is. And my goal as a writer, when you're writing these sort of things, is to find those telling moments that reveal the characters you're writing about, who they really are. So I was, you know, at first I was disappointed, I guess you could say, and kind of perplexed by the response of some of my colleagues. Though the overwhelming response was positive from the media. There was, you know, within the sort of Pentagon press corps and national security and foreign correspondent journalists, there was quite a negative response. But then over time, as the sort of animosity towards me continued, and again, I'm not complaining. Look, I have animosity towards tons of people. I take my shots at people. They're going to slam me. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not really complaining. I'm kind of just looking at it objectively, or as objectively as I can. What happened was I sort of realized that the Pentagon Press Corps is called the Pentagon Press Corps because they're actually an extension of the Pentagon. And that's not to say there aren't great reporters, individuals in there. But in general, that's not their role, is not a watchdog function. When was the last time anyone in the Pentagon Press Corps broke some sort of groundbreaking story? And the answer is they don't. They really don't. There are other reporters at the New York Times who cover that beat who break the big stories, but it's not the guy at the Pentagon.
What did you learn about the relationship between McChrystal and David Petraeus?
Well, now, General David Petraeus and General McChrystal, again, I've been calling it Petraeus envy. So General Petraeus now is at the CIA, but at the time, General McChrystal was always sort of following in General Petraeus' footsteps, and they had this kind of frenemies, friendly rivalry going on. Both of their supporters would say they're the reason we, quote-unquote, won the Iraq War, or that it was, quote, again, I'm using air quotes here, successful. And you have... So this actually plays right into, I sort of talked to General McChrystal about this, and he said, oh, you know, Petraeus couldn't command in Afghanistan. He's trying to keep his distance from it. You know, the White House is worried that Petraeus is going to run for president, and that's what they were worried about, you know, me as well, that I'd become some sort of political general. So you have this kind of really, really fascinating dynamic between these two, and it leads directly into the narrative that I tell, because General Petraeus' greatest skill, what he did the best and what he does the best, is maintain this media fan base, we'll call it. And the media fan base is important because it allows him to bypass the traditional chain of command to push whatever policy or agenda General Petraeus wants to push. And you have McChrystal's people looking at Petraeus and saying, well, look, you know, General Petraeus was on the cover of Newsweek, and he was in Vanity Fair and GQ Man of the Year and Time, and you know, maybe we can pull that sort of same thing off. So that's why they were trying to do, you know, Rolling Stone. I mean, that's why they were on the cover of New York Times Magazine, so McChrystal himself could build up this media fan base, which was quite successful until it wasn't.
You said it was your impression that they hadn't Googled your work and realized what you did. Do you think that the fact that you at least look quite young had anything to do with the fact that they felt they could trust you or mold the story into what they wanted?
Well, thank you for telling me I look young. I don't, it's been a long decade.
well, the photo in the book, anyway.
Yeah, the photo, exactly. Yeah, it was probably airbrushed. Look, I think there's a couple interesting things, and what I had in common, I'm a journalist. I'm not one of these guys. These guys are special forces. They're the elite of the elite. And I don't have much in common with them except that we have the shared experience of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Baghdad during the worst days, and so were they. You know, I'd been in Afghanistan. I'd been through, and I've been shot at and blown up and had people close to me suffer greatly and die, in fact. So there was this bonding that took place just over sharing the war. But I would also say most of the stuff they said that ended up being controversial, they said within the first 12 hours. So it wasn't one of those things where, it didn't take much. It did not take much for them to start shooting their mouths off.
Michael Hastings is with us. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and author of the new book, The Operators, the wild and terrifying inside story of America's war in Afghanistan. We'll be back in a moment. You can join us on the phones at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Hastings, contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and author of the new book, The Operators, the wild and terrifying inside story of America's war in Afghanistan. If you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Michael, Stanley McChrystal was put in command in Afghanistan as a replacement to General David McKiernan. Can you talk about what led to McKiernan's dismissal from command very early in the Obama administration?
Well, what I've said, and I think this is worth repeating, President Obama's mistake, if I can be so bold to criticize the president, wasn't in firing McChrystal, it was in hiring McChrystal. And the previous general, General David McKiernan, was an ally of the president. He had wanted to work with the president. He was not going to be a political headache for the president. But what happened within the Pentagon was that former Defense Secretary Robert Gates and former Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Mike Mullen and David Petraeus all wanted to get their own guy. McKiernan wasn't one of theirs. And so they wanted to get one of their own guy running the war in Afghanistan, and that guy was McChrystal. So essentially they went to President Obama and said, you know, this McKiernan guy doesn't get it. You know, let's put McChrystal in. And President Obama, being in office for only 3 months at the time, basically took their recommendation and fired General McKiernan and replaced him with General McChrystal, someone he didn't know very well. And wouldn't get to know very well until later in the year.
So when you say wasn't one of theirs, Mullins and Gates and Petraeus's, you mean a supporter of counterinsurgency strategy?
Well, that's true. Well, see, this is the tricky part. General McKiernan actually said all the right things about counterinsurgency and was actually adopting a counterinsurgency strategy and had been. But, you know, with these counterinsurgency guys, It's not just about saying the right thing. There's this idea of there's this sort of cultish thing. Like, he didn't really believe it. You know, he didn't really get it. And that's also a cover for what's essentially bureaucratic infighting. You know, General Petraeus used to be McKiernan's subordinate, and then Petraeus leaped ahead of McKiernan. So what they often, you know, the sort of spin was, General McKiernan doesn't get counterinsurgency. He's not dynamic enough to fight the war. That, and from my perspective and from other military officials who I interviewed, that was sort of a cover for what's more typical bureaucratic infighting. I mean, it was brutal. I mean, people forget, when General McKiernan was fired, Admiral Mike Mullen came out and said, he's B team. You know, he's not our A team. I mean, that's a pretty brutal thing to say to somebody, which was all conveniently forgotten a year later when everyone was, you know, wringing their hands over the McChrystal firing. People forgot that, oh, wait, you know, McKiernan had been fired, and that was pretty brutal, too.
And interestingly, among the impressions that McChrystal said to you that were highly controversial was that his first meeting with President Obama, he had the impression that Obama was intimidated by his own military commanders.
Yes. Yeah, this was the I was shocked when I was told that that's what, you know, General McChrystal believed. And I was shocked when that meeting was described to me by sources who were there. And not only was I shocked that, you know, President Obama's a pretty cool customer usually, but it gets at this larger issue, which I had heard about from many military people, that they felt that, you know, President Obama didn't quite understand or wasn't very comfortable with the military, which makes sense. He's not from a military background. His whole campaign was sparked by being against the war in Iraq. So you know, I think there was anxiety on his part, as well as, you know, this sense from the Pentagon brass, oh, who's this Democrat? What's he going to do? This is the guy who called our war in Iraq dumb. He literally said it was a dumb war. So they did not hit it off. And you can see this by just how out of, you know, the White House falls all over itself to show how much they love the troops. And in fact, I just learned recently, I have a story in the book about, you know, a trip the president took to Baghdad in 2008, where I have a State Department official describing the president being very cranky and not wanting to take pictures with the troops and diplomats, which is, you know, which you shouldn't say. Generally, even if you're thinking that, you should not say that within earshot of people who are over there. And the response to that, the State Department apparently just responded to that part of the book saying, oh, you know, that's ridiculous. President Obama loves the troops, you know. And I mean, I think that's telling as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So I want to talk a little bit about this tug of war between the Pentagon and the White House regarding counterinsurgency strategy. First of all, counterinsurgency strategy, when it's described to us in the general public, sounds in many ways like a more peaceful way to do war, perhaps something that is more effective than shooting people down with conventional weapons. Why does it not work out that way in practice, at least according to the reporting that you've done?
Well, I think counterinsurgency, the myth of winning the hearts and minds is just that, it's a myth. And you can look at just the facts to sort of demonstrate that. There were more Afghan civilians killed under General McChrystal's watch when he was instituting, you know, the real deal counterinsurgency, allegedly, than under the previous commander. You know, what General Petraeus did in Iraq, which was supposedly this warm and fuzzy counterinsurgency, actually was about supplying Iraqi armies with weapons, Iraqi police with weapons, so they could operate their own death squads, as well as using brute force. So counterinsurgency, in its most simple definition, the way we practice it, it's making the natives behave in the way we want them to behave. And we do that by the use of force and by other coercive measures like, you know, bribing them, you know, rounding people up, putting, you know, throwing thousands of people in jail. It's not – Hearts and Minds is the biggest, you know, PR campaign and has nothing to do with the reality on the ground.
What if troops – say to you about how they feel about the counterinsurgency strategy? And I have to imagine, even if you had an overwhelming tide of sentiment from them, not every one of them disagreed with counterinsurgency strategy.
No, I'm sure there are some who don't. I have never interviewed an infantryman or a soldier on the front line who thought that COIN was a great thing. Hmm. I mean, it's never actually, maybe a couple. So I won't say never, because I'm sure I have at some point. But most who are doing these day to day realize that it's a joke. I mean, it's, you know, we're not going to understand their culture in the way that the strategy says we need to. But more importantly, and this is very sensitive and it's hard to even discuss publicly, but this is the reality is, and if anyone's being honest, when these soldiers come back and they'll talk to you about, you know, what they think of the Afghans. And there's an intense resentment towards the Afghan people. And the Afghan, you know, and the Afghans resent the Americans. But we can't, that's sort of out of bounds. We have to sort of pretend, oh, no, the Afghans are these great allies, and, you know, we're all working together to help them build schools. But that's not actually the actual dynamic on the ground. And one of the kind of interesting parts of the book, I literally, for like three pages, just list all what the Afghans think of Americans, mm-hmm. and what Americans think of Afghans. And it's all from a classified report that came out of last year. And it's pretty crazy stuff. I mean, you know, the Afghans will say, oh, we think the Americans are cowards. And then the Americans say, no, we think the Afghans are cowards. And then the Americans say, oh, well, the Afghans smell and do drugs. And the Afghans will say, well, no, the Americans, are insult our women. You know, and it's just back and forth, and it just shows the complete breakdown in trust. And what do we expect? And we saw this in the video that just came out, last week of the Marines and the dead Taliban.
Mm-hmm. The soldiers also told you that they felt like counterinsurgency put their lives at risk in those situations where they were ordered not to use their weapons.
Yeah, it did. It did. And the most tragic part of the book, and to me what made the book worth writing, and the reason really why I wrote it, was because there was a kid named Sergeant Michael Ingram. And Michael Ingram was, 23 years old, you know, bright future, same old story, you know. And he went out on patrol, and he went into a house, and he stepped on a bomb, and he was killed in front of all his friends. And the tragedy there was that the house that he was killed when he went into should not have even been there. They should have been able to tear it down. His unit should have been able to tear it down, but he was not allowed. They were not allowed to tear this house down because of this, you know, counterinsurgency, making friends with the locals strategy. So they don't tear the house down, and then the Taliban use it as a way to blow up the Americans. And man, I have to say, it's just, you know, I've interviewed his stepmom, and I've talked to his close friends, and it's like, you know, is it worth it? You know, is it worth it? And then, because that's, in the end of the day, the book comes down to, we talk about the policy, we talk about these things, but unless you're the family receiving the casket, and has to live every day, and every year you have the anniversary of your son's death to look forward to, you know, it's pretty unbearable.
What did you learn about Stanley McChrystal's knowledge of the cover-up in the Pat Tillman friendly fire incident?
You know, it's interesting. When I just researched it, you know, it was very clear that he knew. He knew that it was friendly fire right from the beginning. And instead of telling the family, which is what you're supposed to do, he wrote a memo to Vice President Cheney, President Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, and he said, if you guys mention, essentially, I'm going to paraphrase here, but essentially he said, if you guys mention Tillman's death publicly, if he said, be very careful not to say how he died, because if the real reason why he died became public, it would cause embarrassment. Mm-hmm. So essentially, he's sending this memo up to the chain of command to cover himself. But also, it was very deceitful to say, you know, well, we haven't decided whether we're going to tell you what really happened. But if we do decide it, that's why you should be very careful not to say, oh, he died like this or that, because then you can be accused, then it could be embarrassing.
So it wasn't a matter of this still being under investigation and certain facts being unclear. They had reached a conclusion about what happened.
They were pretty sure pretty quickly what happened. And even if it was still under investigation, but all the regulations say the minute you think it's friendly fire, you have to tell the family. Mm-hmm. You have to. It's because, you know, families want to know this stuff and they need to know it. And to avoid situations like this. But to see a memo that says, yeah, we know it's friendly fire, and if we decide to tell the public about it, you know, it's going to look bad, so be careful how you spin things, essentially what it was. And this happened during the 2004 presidential election. So it was not a benign memo. It was a very politically savvy memo to cover his tracks and to cover his butt, in the wake of this horrible tragedy with the Tillman family. I mean, you know, I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to interview Mary Tillman, Pat Tillman's mother, but the trauma they went through in trying to get answers about what happened to their son is just horrific. And he never apologized to them. McChrystal never apologized to the Tillman family.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Michael Hastings, author of The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. We'll go to the phones now. We have John on the line in Richardson. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you today? I love the show.
Thank you.
Hey, I just wanted to know if the paradigm or paradigm, what am I saying? When I was at the Naval War College, we discussed the MacArthur-Truman fiasco, mm-hmm. and how MacArthur rose to prominence under one president and then was essentially insubordinate under the next president and was relieved of command for his insubordination. Did you ever discuss that precedent with McChrystal or his staff?
You know what's funny? That's a great point. You know, one of his top staffers called General McChrystal MacArthur without the arrogance. That's how he would describe him. And I think you're describing the right dynamic here. You know, both McChrystal and Petraeus had become accustomed to having George W. Bush as president. You know, General Petraeus was used to talking to George Bush every week. President Bush every week. So McChrystal, when he becomes in charge, he's expecting that same sort of one-on-one contact, and he doesn't get it, you know, and this upsets him greatly. And in fact, he gives this notorious interview to 60 Minutes a few months into his tenure, where he tells 60 Minutes, oh yeah, President Obama's only spoken to me once since I've been over here, which of course is hugely embarrassing to the president, it makes big news, makes headlines everywhere, and it really upset the White House. But I think you're right. I think that, you know, it's a similar dynamic, certainly with Truman and MacArthur.
McChrystal was reprimanded by the president when he was publicly critical of the vice president. But did he come out of that meeting chastened in any way?
I don't think so. I don't think you chasten a guy like Stanley McChrystal. That's just not in his DNA. Even you know, since leaving his command or being relieved of his command, the public statements General McChrystal has made have been quite critical, really, of the White House, and not as explicit, but pretty critical. And apparently, according to my sources, he's been giving off the record interviews to other journalists, saying about, you know, there's no trust between the Pentagon and the White House. So again, I feel like I've been pretty tough on General McChrystal these last 10 minutes. So I probably should, you know, and I think like in the book, you know, one gets a fuller picture. We're talking about just kind of the sort of more negative aspects of his career, but there's also some quite impressive things as well.
Let me ask you this: is the disdain that you saw among top military leadership for civilian leadership, is that, do you think, unique to McChrystal and his staff, or is that something that probably always exists and, as we've discussed earlier, doesn't necessarily get reported on?
I think there's clearly I think there's the tension exists. And the question is, you know, how bad is it at this point, or how bad wasn't? I think it had gotten much, much worse. I think after 10 years of these wars, it had reached a real low point. Because it wasn't, this was not, you know, there was the famous incident in the previous administration under President Bush called the Revolt of the Generals. Remember, those were all retired generals, mm-hmm. right? Here you had a revolt of the generals who are serving under your command, and one national security reporter then would later quote a top official saying it was a 7 days of May scenario, you know, in reference to the movie about the military coup. But the fact that, you know, they didn't say it at the time. I was reporting this at the time. You know, Woodward reported this, and then later on, everyone's like, oh yeah, it was kind of like the Pentagon launched a coup, mm-hmm. you know. So I think in retrospect, that's, you know, it's a very, very interesting question. And I think that the you know, military-civilian relationship goes up and down. I think we've reached a very, very low point.
Michael Hastings is contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and author of the new book, The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. You can join our conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Hastings, who's contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and author of The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. I do want to talk about this. Stanley McChrystal was tied in very tightly with his own team. Essentially, you write that both sides were willing to die for the other. What do you think inspired that sort of trust and loyalty?
It's the band of brothers mentality, I think, is the, you know, best way to put it. But also, I think, you know, people really they really loved General McChrystal, and they would have done anything for him. And those sorts of relationships that became formed through combat, through bond, through basically, you know, living and hanging out and sharing risk and sharing all these experiences together were very very strong bonds.
I want to talk also about the carousing that you witnessed. I have to say this. I mean, in my years as a reporter, I was not invited to drink with people that I was covering, certainly not on a regular basis. And you were not told before these sessions, hey, look, come out with us, have a beer, but this is off the record.
No, in fact, the opposite was true of the first big blowout in Paris, where I was told by the public relations guy, you know, as long as you put this in the proper context, you know, we think it could be interesting, you know, about how, you know, even on his anniversary, it was General McChrystal's anniversary, he's spending it with his guys. So, in fact, the opposite was true.
Mm-hmm. And not only his anniversary, but an anniversary with a wife that he'd spent like a month a year with for the past 7 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it shows the sort of dedication that these men do have to their jobs and, in fact, the kind of mentality that it takes to become a general and what that does to you. I mean, these are guys who would rather be in Kabul than in Paris. They'd rather be in Kabul than in Washington. You know, I mean, that's a particular kind of mentality. And so, you know, and it's the kind that's going to knock back a few beers, you know, and you know, say what they think.
But as a war correspondent, there's something about that that you can relate to.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. I mean, it's a, you know, I was, you know, I don't drink very much, and I had not drank for 10 years. I'd stopped drinking at the end of high school. Remember, I earlier referenced getting kicked out of college.
Right.
And so I hadn't actually drank for quite a while. So it was an interesting experience, and I did not drink with them. But then later, and I describe this in the book, I went, you know, this sort of three-day period in Dubai where I just went on a bender myself. Because I kind of got caught up in the excitement of and the testosterone of being with these guys. And you can sort of, you know, see how that could just easily be done. I think, and again, I think, you know, it's one thing if you're going with a source and you're drinking, you know, that happens all the time. I mean, Washington is lubricated by booze.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is, you know, again, it goes back to this idea, I'm writing a profile, you know. You cannot get a more compelling scene than the commanding general in Iraq in a bar in Paris with his men in a circle, you know, screaming the lyrics of the song, I Want to Be on the Cover of Rolling Stone. And that's what happened.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ron in Richardson. Hello, Ron.
Well, thank you. Great program. I think it's ranks up there when you had the gentleman that wrote the Pat Tillman biography. Was it Jan Kramer?
Sebastian Junger?
And he pointed out...
Oh, Krakauer, John Krakauer.
Krakauer. And he pointed out that the people that were intimately involved, like McChrystal, were rewarded and promoted for lying to the Tillman family, to his comrades and the American people. Using that as an example, and then looking at Jessica Lynch, another fabrication...
Mm-hmm.
Questions about the most recent Congressional Medal of Honor winner, the fact that the intelligence that took us to war in Iraq was fabricated by the Defense Department. We've had 9 years of repeated failure in two different fronts. When will the zone of immunity be lifted by major news organizations on the Pentagon? I mean, NPR follows the generals around, quotes verbatim, and there's never any follow-up. I'm just filled with contempt for 90% of the press, and I just say your guest is one of the few people that I consider a real journalist in this country. And that's basically my comment and question. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Michael?
I appreciate it. Your caller is getting me fired up as well, listing some of those things. And, I mean, yeah. I mean, this is exactly – look, I had this thing to add one to the list. You know, we had this video last week of these Marines desecrating the bodies of the Afghan Taliban, and then you had all these senior leaders in Washington come out and say, oh, how horrified they were that this could happen. And you know, and I thought that was pretty rich. These are folks who've been sending these guys to do these things, you know, pouring weapons and money into the most unsavory hands in these countries, in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And then when something looks bad, because it's caught on a YouTube video, they throw the little guy out to dry, and that's what it is. And your caller was exactly right. You know, even for there's this sort of immunity that guys like General McChrystal have, General Petraeus have, General George Casey. But, you know, people who have made mistake after mistake get immunity. Where Paul Wolfowitz, basically, you know, you can go through the list. You can go through the list of the villains. Well, not even villains is even the wrong word. I should actually take that back. You go through the list, and the people in power get the immunity, where it's the little guys, the soldiers, the Lindy England and Edward Grave, these guys, these Marines, who are going to get hammered. You know, they get hung out to dry every time, and it's so rare that anyone has called into account the fact that all our top generals have said for 10 years, almost every month, we're winning or we've won. and they still get treated as credible voices of authority.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Miguel on the line in Plano. Hello, Miguel.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yes, I just wanted to make a remark and ask a question. My remark is that a lot of the definitions, sir, that you mentioned about the counterinsurgency and things of that nature are not really accurate. You seem to have a certain basic knowledge of it, but the depth is lacking tremendously, and anybody that knows anything about that will tell you that. I believe that, yes, the war was wrong. I'm not for the war. Yes, I was in the service. I was Special Operations Ranger, paratrooper, and all that other stuff. Exciting, yes. But let me tell you what, I hold those generals in the highest remarks, and most of them are there because they're honorable people and they're doing what they have to do because it's necessary. Now, however, are they perfect? No, they're not. But you know what? Without them, we will not be safe in many ways. My question to you, sir, is what are your credentials to make such statements in such an absolute manner? My understanding is that lots of the most credible shows in this country, especially news shows, lots of journalists have not supported you in many of your comments, and particularly in this last book.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, I appreciate the question, and definitely fair enough. And as far as my credentials, you know, I'm a journalist. I've spent the last 6 years of my life dedicated to understanding the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in terms of my experience with counterinsurgency, I read all the manuals, but more importantly, I've seen it play out, and it doesn't work. I mean, so we can talk about the different economic elements and the different public information and elements to it, but the reality is, you know, it doesn't work. Look, Iraq right now is unraveling again into a civil war after we've spent $1.3 trillion there. So, and even statistically, you can look at studies that RAND has done, which say, you know, only 11% of counterinsurgency operations are successful to defeat terrorist organizations. So, you know, it's fair enough, and you're correct. Also, my colleagues have criticized my work, but, you know, look, I'm criticizing their work too. So, again, it's sort of, you know, if you're in the arena, you're going to both give and take shots. And I'd also like to point out, you know, I appreciate, you know, my younger brother was in the military. He was an infantry platoon leader, won a Bronze Star. Some of my best friends are in the service. I appreciate the service you gave, and I'm sure, and I wouldn't disagree. A lot of them, a lot of the people who do this are doing it for the right reasons, and have done things, and have the ability to make us safer. I just don't know if the resources are being used in a way that actually makes us safer. I mean, I guess my question to the caller would be, do you feel any safer now than you did after September 11th?
Let me ask you about your personal response, the reaction, when you found out that Stanley McChrystal was being fired and that the catalyst was unquestionably your article. On the one hand, it's got to be gratifying to feel as if the things you are writing actually have an impact on the world. On the other hand, you have to ask yourself, even internally, once again, am I positive that everything I put down there was entirely accurate?
Oh, it was definitely. The accuracy wasn't the question. It was the shock of, man, you know, as I told the caller, you know, I've been writing about these issues for 6 years, and you usually write about it, and it's like a drop in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So there was never any question that literally every comma, every sentence, every fact was as, you know, as imperfect of a medium as journalism is, as perfect as you could make it.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your editors were particularly tough going into publishing this piece?
Oh, my, yeah. I mean, Rolling Stone is one of the few publications that has fact checkers anymore. And you know, we were, you know, they were really, really tough to make sure we got everything right. And I'm, you know, I try to get, you know, as I said, it's imperfect, but I try to get, you know, as much right as possible. But in terms of the response, you know, when it hit, I was in Kandahar in southern Afghanistan, and you know, it was quite shocking to see that. I mean, the irony is the thesis of my original story was that President Obama, you know, was kind of too much of a wimp to fire a general, to stand up to the Pentagon. And he clearly proved me wrong within 48 hours.
Hmm.
But also, on a more serious note, What I did not quite understand, and what General McChrystal and his staff did not quite understand, and what a lot of people at the Pentagon didn't understand, was just how thin the ice was that he was on, and how angry the White House had been at the Pentagon, particularly Vice President Biden.
How has the war effort in Afghanistan changed since McChrystal's departure?
How has it changed? Mm-hmm. I mean, General Petraeus came in and he upped the level of violence across the board. I think the interesting change is that we are now getting out, essentially. As President Obama said, the tide of war is receding. So I think it's been a kind of fascinating, tragic, but fascinating transition. Again, the generals have tried to hold on and tried to keep a number of troops there, but more troops than the president wanted to. So again, we've seen that sort of confrontation play out where, the president had said, look, I said we're going to take these troops home and we're going to do it despite protests from the generals, and he overruled them this time.
What do you imagine will happen there once the drawdown is complete?
It's going to be some sort of low-level civil war with the level of violence that we're seeing now. It might be less, it might be more. We can look at Iraq, obviously two different situations, but there will be score settling. There will be a local fight for power. And the question is, what role are we going to play in that?
So a story, Michael, like the one you published a year and a half ago is amazing in some ways. It raises your profile. I wonder if people aren't, afraid to take your call now. They don't want to be alone in a room with you. Has it changed your ability to get really close to your sources?
No, not really. I'm not on the Pentagon's Christmas card list. I might be on their drone strike list. Mm-hmm. But seriously, I have pretty good relationships with sources, in all different parts of the government. It does, and once you get associated with a sort of political viewpoint, there's both pros and cons to that. The pros, that people who are sympathizing with you are more willing to talk, where those who, believe they don't share your political viewpoints may not. But it's always difficult to get really good information, whether you're unknown or known, whether you have been accused of having a political slant or not. But I think the track record I have since publishing that story, we published four major magazine pieces in Rolling Stone, and I haven't had too much difficulty getting access to anybody.
Michael Hastings is contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. His new book is called The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. Michael, it's been a really interesting hour, and I so appreciate you spending it with us.
Thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers our telephones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.